What kinds of birds do you see around your yard? Maybe the robins, cardinals, chickadees, blue jays, and maybe some sparrows? Well, what kinds of sparrows? According to a new book, there are 76 kinds in North America that we could pay attention to, and our guest says they're as complicated as they are common. Rick Wright leads birds and art tours in Europe and the Americas, and he's the author of the Peterson Reference Guide to Sparrows of North America. Rick, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be with you today.
Well, sparrows, Rick, I learned from your book, are a lot more complicated than I would have thought. Some things we call sparrows are not related to the sparrows we have in North America. Some things we don't call sparrows are sparrows. Sort out for us what fits into this book.
Yeah, the English names of birds are just a huge historical mess. Sparrow, historically, has come to mean just little brown streaky bird that I can't really be bothered to look at more closely and identify. And so there are lots of birds around the world called sparrows that aren't necessarily all that closely related each to the other. Our American sparrows, for example, are not at all closely related to the house sparrows and the Eurasian tree sparrows that are familiar to most of us. But they share the same name because they're about the same size. They're sparrow-sized and about the same color. They're sparrow-colored and about the same pattern. They have sparrow patterns. At the same time, among the American sparrows, we have birds that are called in English sparrow, but we also have birds that are called brushfinch and towhee and junco. So English names have a really complicated but really fascinating history, and they don't always tell us about the genuine relationships of our birds.
And that's something about your book. It isn't just a field guide to sparrows, though it is that. It's also a story of how we as humans have interacted with these birds, discovered them, and tried in different ways to categorize them, right?
That's right, yeah. And that, to me, is every bit as interesting as the birds themselves. Birds are really neat little animals, and I really like looking at them and thinking about them and talking about them. But what fascinates me and has always fascinated me are the people who look at the birds. The people who look at the birds try to figure out what they're doing, try to figure out where and how they live, and ultimately and fundamentally, what they are. What does it mean when we look at a bird and say, that is a sparrow, or, oh, that bird is different from other birds that I've looked at? The way that the human mind works to categorize things using similarity and difference is exemplified in the way that over the last four centuries now, we've dealt with the American sparrows.
And it's changed a lot because now we can look at the DNA of different birds. We can try to figure out their evolutionary family tree. How has that shaken up the way we put birds into this category and not that category?
That's a really interesting thing, and I'm not certain that we have reached the end of biochemical study of birds and their genetics, but a lot of birds that we used to think were closely related just visually or just sort of by gut feeling turn out to be not all that closely related. For a long time, including when I was a young birder 40 years ago, for a long time, we lumped all of the birds with thick seed-eating bills into one great big family. So all the buntings and the cardinals and the dixisole and the sparrows and the towhees, we thought were just one big family, identified most easily by that crushing bill, the bill that they use to eat seeds. But work in the genetics of birds has discovered that these are actually not all that closely related. So while the American sparrows form a distinct group known as a family, we talk about the family of American sparrows, the cardinals, which share a similar bill, are in a different family. The indigo bunting, which shares a similar bill, is in a different family. The old world buntings, which some of your listeners may have seen, are in yet another family. So the recourse to genetic study of birds' relationships has given us a very different picture from what we thought just a few decades ago.
Talking to Rick Wright about his new book, The Peterson Reference Guide to Sparrows of North America. Rick, when it comes to birding, are sparrows really sought after by most casual birders? Are they the stars of the show?
I wouldn't say that there is such a thing as a casual birder. I think that once you start looking at birds, you tend to get hooked. And as you go on and gain a little more experience and a little more familiarity with the birds, many birders moving beyond that that first stage of being a beginning birder. Many birders simply fall in love with the sparrows, and there are lots of good reasons for that. Identification of sparrows, in spite of hoary tradition, is not all that difficult. There are really rather few sparrows that can't be identified readily when you get a good view. They have just the right amount of challenge and just the right amount of identifiability to be really satisfying birds to look at. And many of them, in spite of the fact that we think of sparrows as sort of smudgy, brown, and streaky, many of them are just terrifically beautiful.
Now, you've got over 6 dozen species of sparrow in your book. Are there any common themes? Is there anything that we could say about all of them, or is there just too much variety to make a general statement?
Well, there is a lot of variety, and it's important to note that the 75 or 76 different kinds of sparrows that are treated in the book aren't all considered separate species. And I'm very careful in the book to talk about kinds of sparrows or flavors of sparrows. Lots of sparrow species are quite variable over their range. The classic example, of course, is the juncos. In the Midwest and over much of North America, we have only one species, the dark-eyed junco, but it has so much geographic variation that we split it, as most birders split the species, into recognizable kinds in the field. So you've got not just the familiar slate-colored and Oregon juncos, but you've got white-winged juncos and gray-headed juncos and pink-sided juncos. Just a great diversity, even in the unity of one sparrow species, the dark-eyed junco. Across the entire family, it's very hard to identify any characteristics that they all have in common. What comes down to the basis of the modern classification is genetic work. All of the sparrows are descended from a common ancestor.
One thing I found fascinating is looking at the body types of some of these birds and matching it up with their behavior. Like, do they migrate? Do they migrate a long way or a short way? And how that translates into, say, their wingspan? What kind of things can we observe?
Yeah, that's right. And that's a fascinating thing that the birder can actually see quite well in the field or at the feeder. Birds, not just sparrows, but birds in general, that migrate long distances tend to have long, pointed, powerful wings and, for the most part, short tails, while birds that migrate short distances or not at all have short, round wings and long tails, which allow those more sedentary birds to maneuver nicely through thickets and brush piles, but wouldn't allow them to migrate the hundreds or even thousands of miles that some sparrows migrate. So just looking closely at the shape of a bird, looking closely at the shape of any bird, can sometimes give you a hint about its way of life.
In addition to the birds in the book, there are a bunch of recurring human characters that keep coming up from bird to bird. You look at the history of how the birds were observed and named and sometimes accidentally renamed, even though they'd already been named. One familiar name, John Audubon. Can you talk about his role when it comes to the identification of the sparrow family?
Yeah, Audubon is an enduringly fascinating figure. And he came rather late to most sparrow identification, but that didn't stop him. He decided that very often his images, the paintings that he produced, were better than any produced before. And a few times he claimed to have discovered sparrows that had actually been described some time before he first encountered them. So even though he doesn't count as the discoverer of many of our sparrows, he's still one of the most prominent personalities. I think of a bird that is moving in small numbers through western Wisconsin right now, the Harris sparrow, a very large, very beautiful, sad-voiced sparrow of the tundra in Canada. And Audubon named the Harris sparrow for his friend and patron, Edward Harris, and more or less didn't care that the bird had been discovered a dozen years earlier by another of Audubon's friends, Thomas Nuttall.
We are talking about sparrows with Rick Wright. He leads birds and art tours in Europe and the Americas. He's the author of the Peterson Reference Guide to Sparrows of North America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see any kinds of sparrows around your house throughout the year? Do you see any of them right now? Do you have a question about how to identify sparrows, what fits into this family and what doesn't? If you are a birder, I guess there's no casual birders. If you're a birder yourself, have you specialized in sparrows of any sort? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. That was the song of the dark-eyed junco, actually a type of sparrow, part of the same family. We're talking about some of the many kinds of sparrows out there in North America. Rick Wright is our guest. He leads birds and art tours in Europe and the Americas. We're talking about his new book, The Peterson Reference Guide to Sparrows of North America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you bird? Do you look for different kinds of sparrows? Have you seen any in your backyard lately? What do you look for around the year? And do you have questions about how to identify these guys for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Rick, you mentioned the Harris sparrow. Who else pays a visit to us here in the Midwest?
Well, right now, those of us on the East Coast, I'm in New Jersey right now, those of us on the East Coast are very jealous because you've got good numbers of Vesper sparrows passing through. Vesper sparrow named for the probably erroneous folk belief that they sing their beautiful song mostly in the evening. You've also got one of the most colorful of the North American sparrows, the little tiny, somewhat secretive LeConte sparrow moving through the Midwest right now. This is a bird with an orange face and a white stripe down the crown and an orange breast and a very strangely colored neck. It's almost purple. It's a mixture of gray and silver and green that looks purple in the field. One of the most beautiful of the sparrows and definitely worth getting out to look for if you've got a chance right now. We're the end of April right now. Another week, you'll start to see Nelson sparrows, another very handsome, colorful sparrow. And you should be seeing right now good numbers of dark-eyed juncos and white-throated sparrows pushing through. Some of the most abundant sparrows on the continent, some of the most abundant birds on the continent, in fact, moving north in big waves the end of April.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bridget is with us in Seymour. Bridget, hi.
Hello. I just love the little white-crowned sparrows when they come to town. They just bounce along the ground underneath my feeder. They don't necessarily land on the feeder, though.
All right. And what time of year do you usually see those, Bridget?
Oh, well, this spring I'll be seeing them. They always migrate. And the chipping sparrows, they always sing a little song for me.
All right. Right. Bridget, yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, Ray.
Bridget brings up a really interesting point about the white-crowned sparrows tending not to land on the feeder but on the ground. A lot of sparrows, like white-crowned sparrows, are fairly terrestrial, spending most of their time feeding on the ground. But there are other sparrows that spend time high up in the trees at certain times of year. Right now, one of my favorites is coming through the Midwest, the clay-colored sparrow. And clay-colored sparrows, which tend to spend most of the year on the ground or in low bushes, this time of year will be quite high in the trees, eating the seeds of elm trees as they form. So that's a neat trick this time of year to help you find some clay-colored sparrows.
Thanks for that call, Bridget. And as Bridget was talking, I flipped open your book, Rick, to look at the white-crowned sparrow, and I see it's one of the most frequently misidentified, I'm quoting here, of passerellid sparrows, even 2.5 centuries after it was described. Why is it easy to mix up with other sparrows and other birds?
Because, first off, the adult with that striking badger-like black and white head pattern superficially resembles the white-throated sparrow. And it can be easy if you don't get a good view or if you're not paying particularly close attention. It can be easy to confuse the adults with white-throated sparrows. More interestingly, the white-throated sparrow has a first winter plumage, that is to say, the plumage that white-crowned sparrows wear for the first 7 months or so of their life that lacks the black and white. Instead of black and white, which gives it the name white-crowned sparrow, they have rusty and buff. And that pattern and those colors can suggest any number of other sparrows. White-crowned sparrows are often misidentified as chipping sparrows, as rufous-crowned sparrows, as just about anything because they look so very different from those flashy black-and-white adults.
Well, I like that the idea of it being badger-headed. That makes the white-crowned sparrow a fine Wisconsin bird. Thanks for the call, Bridget. We'll go to Mike now in Green Bay. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. For your guest there, I'm wondering about the English or house sparrow and being an invasive species. And I just started to learn this now, that that they're killing eggs and killing adults and stealing nests, and that people are actually trapping them and eradicating them. Is that true, I guess?
That's true, yes. The house sparrow, which again is one of these sparrow birds that's not especially closely related to our New World sparrows, was introduced to North America in the 1850s, largely by German immigrants who just felt a little bit homesick for a familiar bird that they would see around their towns and villages and barnyards. And so they brought house sparrows into North America to remind them of back home. At that time, in the mid-19th century, there was a lot of agriculture in the United States, so lots of waste grain, and the principal mode of transportation was not the car, obviously, or the jet plane, but the horse. And house sparrows are very happy going through what horses leave on the roads of cities and towns to look for seeds that are left over. So the bird just exploded in abundance and in range and is now found all over North America. People don't nowadays like house sparrows very much because house sparrows are cavity nesters. Our native North American sparrows all build little nests on the ground or in trees, but house sparrows build cavity nests in cavities. They can't dig their own cavities because their bills aren't strong enough. So what they do is usurp the cavities that are dug by woodpeckers and other birds and are occupied by things like house wrens and bluebirds and downy woodpeckers. And house sparrows are pretty rambunctious. They will go into, say, a bluebird box and evict the bluebirds, sometimes even killing the bluebirds. Same thing with some small woodpeckers and wrens. And so there are more or less concerted efforts over much of the continent to control house sparrows. And controlling house sparrows, yes, it means killing them. It means trapping them and removing them from the environment. I'm very fond of house sparrows, but I have to say in North America, I'm fonder even of the native birds of North America. I wish the house sparrows weren't here. They are. We need to do something to protect our native birds. But as long as they're here, I guess we can enjoy our house sparrows, which are very cheerful little birds.
Mike, thanks for that call. We are talking to Rick Wright, author of the Peterson Reference Guide to Sparrows of North America. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Hayward. Hello, Jim.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jim?
I wanted to talk about how many sparrows are actually coming through. We've this year so far that seems like not many. We've got one song sparrow, three tree sparrows, and one fox sparrow couple. And we just wondered, it just seems like hardly any.
Jim, thanks for the call. Are there concerns, Rick, about numbers of particular kinds or species of sparrows in North America?
The sparrows that Jim mentioned are all common and doing well, and are generally signs of sort of the end of the first phase of spring migration. So I think Jim can remain hopeful that he's going to see a lot more sparrows coming in over the next couple of weeks. There are, however, sparrows that are in very bad shape. The Florida subspecies of the grasshopper sparrow, a bird that I believe is also listed as threatened or at least of special concern in Wisconsin, the Florida subspecies of grasshopper sparrow is in very bad shape, very low populations, and declining. It's quite possible that the grasshopper sparrow of Florida will be the next group the next subspecies of North American birds to go extinct, in fact. Another one that weighs heavy on my heart here in New Jersey is the salt marsh sparrow, which has a very long breeding range up and down the Atlantic coast. But as its name suggests, it lives in salt marshes. And it's rare to find salt marsh that's much more than a mile wide. So though it's got a very long breeding range, it has an extraordinarily narrow breeding range. And with global warming and the rise of sea levels, salt marshes are becoming rarer, smaller, more subject to unexpected flooding. And the salt marsh sparrow is another bird that is in bad shape and sadly enough, quite possibly on its way out.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Time for one more caller. Steve is with us in Little Suamico. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Comment
and a question. The storm we had 2 weeks ago, we saw an influx of about 15 to 20 fox sparrows, and they hung around. It's just a blast to watch these little guys scrape through the snow and the seeds and the grass. We really enjoyed them, but we are about 15 miles north of Green Bay in a kind of swampy, wooded area. I was wondering what other type of sparrows we can expect to see coming through this particular area.
In our last minute, Rick, a good swampy sparrow.
Oh, a good swampy sparrow is the Lincoln sparrow for sure. You say swampy woods, and my mind immediately goes to Lincoln sparrow, a very subtly colored but very beautiful, very handsome, rather large sparrow named by John James Audubon for a friend of his in Maine, Tom Lincoln.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot. And Rick, what's the next visitor you're looking for out there on the coast when it comes to sparrows?
Well, I had a great time this morning because I got to see a white crown sparrow. They're just starting to come through, a bit more common back your way and scarce enough out here to make a red letter day.
Rick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always fun to talk about sparrows.
That's Rick Wright. He leads birds and art tours in Europe and the Americas. He joined us for a look at his new book, The Peterson Reference Guide to Sparrows of North America.